Hello, everyone, and welcome to this session where we talk about digital marketing strategy from the perspective of differentiation. So, positioning the lecture to the course framework, you can see here. So, we talk about competitive advantage quite much today. And we have already gone through how to create buyer personas. So, how to first of all understand the customer needs. And today we focus on differentiation. How do you actually create a competitive advantage that allows a company to differentiate from its competitors? And the learning goal for today is to analyze how a firm can leverage competitive advantages to differentiate itself from competitors in the digital age. So we put somewhat special emphasis on the competitive advantages that the digitalization allows us to build. So first of all, something basic regarding the differentiation and competitive advantages. First of all, if you think about competition in general, there are two major archetypes of a competitive strategy. One is cost leadership, and the second is differentiation. Cost leadership allows a company to offer low prices for the customer or sell offerings with better margins. So, this type of strategy is very typical when the company is selling commodities or raw materials or some quite basic products where differentiation is very difficult to achieve. So think of electricity, as you can see here, Vattenfall logo, although I don't take a stand about their competitive strategy, but quite typical when you're selling electricity, it's homogeneous product. So it's really hard to differentiate the product as such. So in such industries, usually the cost leadership is at least a big part of the competitive strategy. Then again, a differentiation enables a company to set its offering apart from its competitors. So think of any brand or a company that is producing clearly distinguished products, like Apple, for example, usually aligns with this differentiation strategy. So they try to build product services and experiences that are clearly different from the competitors. And this is the major strategy that we are going to discuss today. Sustainable competitive advantage. So we could discuss competitive advantages or sustainable competitive advantages. The difference is that sustainable refers to such competitive advantages that are not easily imitated by competitors. So it is something that the competitors cannot copy overnight or in a short period of time. Let me start from the figure on the right-hand side, which depicts the environment, first of all, where every single company operates. So every single company operates under a specific context where technologies are developing. There might be some structural changes in the industry. New regulations might be enforced, or let's say changes in consumer needs or behaviors might happen gradually. So this is the context where every single company operates, and the company has very little control over how this context sort of evolves. But the three very essential pieces when thinking about competitive advantages are the smaller circles that create this Venn diagram, so to speak. So the three cornerstones of building competitive advantages is, first of all, customer needs, competitors' offerings, and then companies' capabilities or strengths. So to build and sustain a competitive advantage, first of all, you need to understand very well customer needs. So you need to have a deep understanding of what do the customers actually want, what kind of problems, what kind of goals they have, and so on. Then you need to understand how competitors are trying to address those customer needs. So what kind of offerings, products, services, experiences they are delivering. And finally, you need to understand what are the specific strengths that the company has to be able to address a specific set of customer needs. And this triangle that you can see here is marked as the sweet spot, which is the competitive advantage, in other words. So the core idea is to build something, build an area where the company can meet customer needs in ways that competitors cannot match, given the changes in the context or the business environment. And there are a few key characteristics of a sustainable competitive advantage. So first of all, the sustainable competitive advantage should be based on customer needs. So first of all, you need to understand these needs once again. The SCA enables superior value creation to customer needs in relation to the competitors. So you need to have the capabilities to clearly differentiate from competitors' offerings so that you can justifiably say that you can meet certain customer needs in ways that competitors cannot match. And the third one, the third characteristic states that SCA is difficult to duplicate or substitute. So that means that whatever you're offering toward the customer needs, you should make sure that the competitors cannot just simply copy or imitate your approach. So, figuratively speaking, you should build walls or moats between the competitors' offers and your offers to be able to find the sweet spot. So this is kind of like a theoretical idea of how to build competitive advantages. And I already mentioned the term moat, which is coined by Warren Buffett, the most famous investor of all times, I would argue. So again, the sustainable refers to the idea that the competitive advantage should be difficult to imitate by competitors. And Warren Buffett uses this moat as a metaphor for sustainable competitive advantage. Just like a moat protected a medieval castle from bandits or other attackers, sustainable competitive advantage protects a firm from competitive advantage. So you should have some sort of a moat, some sort of protection toward what you offer for the customers. A good business is like a strong castle with a deep moat around it. I want sharks in the moat. I want it untouchable. So this is very important for the long-term performance and success for any single company. If your competitive advantage relies on something that other companies can easily introduce, let's say a similar feature or whatever, then your long-term success might be harmed by your competitors. So the idea is to build something unique that competitors cannot imitate. Now, in this slide, this is a list of different types of sources of sustainable competitive advantage. And I put sustainable in parentheses because it's always a little bit arguable how sustainable any competitive advantage can be, but at least it should be something that, as said, cannot be imitated in a short period of time. So at least it would take years for the companies to match your competitive advantage, preferably even longer. So the first type of or category of competitive advantages is brands. So brand loyalty and trademarks, where you have high brand awareness or unique brand image. Think of a luxury brand like Louis Vuitton, for example. So it's a highly recognizable brand in its own product category among its target audiences. And they have this very unique brand image of creating something extra luxurious to its customers. So that gives them an edge compared to many other companies. And it also gives them a lot of ability to offer higher prices and that the customers are still willing to pay for. So that is, brands are obviously maybe one of the strongest competitive advantages that you can have if you have this very strong brand. The second is offerings. So, for example, superior product or service that is innovative or otherwise difficult to copy. Think of Apple, for example, that is famous for its smart devices, iPhones, iPads, and so on. So many, many people at least perceive that this product is superior to its competitors. Many competitors have been trying to imitate a lot of the features that Apple smart devices have, but haven't been quite able to copy all those features, at least so that many consumers feel that way, that Apple is just the best product in the market. So that can be a very strong competitive advantage. Often intellectual property related to the offering, think of patents. So those are very typical in pharmaceutical companies. Think of secret formulas like Coca-Cola is one famous example. A lot of companies have tried to imitate the Coca-Cola's secret recipe of how to produce this cola drink. However, no other company has quite matched Coca-Cola. And obviously, Coca-Cola is also a big branding case, clearly. Then algorithms can also be related to the intellectual property. So think of Google, for example. They have created this search engine that most people consider the best in the market. So they were able to create an algorithm that produces the most relevant search results against user queries. And it's been a couple of decades that other search engines have been trying to match Google, but haven't been able to do so. Superior customer experience, that can be one competitive advantage. So either you provide superior convenience. The case of Amazon could be used here. So many consumers think that they just provide this very easy, convenient purchasing process, for example. Or then it could be something experiential. So think of Disney World, for example. So that brand is very focused on creating unique experiences for the consumers that are probably very difficult to match. Complementary products and services, I'm going to discuss in a little bit more, but the idea is that the products and services sort of complement each other, creating a lock-in effect. So when you buy a product, you're also very likely to buy the additional services. That can be also a rather strong competitive advantage for many companies. Location, obviously. Physical store locations, if you are the market leader, let's say in groceries, we can see a lot of this. So if you're a market leader and you have this history of being able to sell your products at the best locations possible, it's hard to attack that kind of company at scale because it's hard to find similarly good locations. This can be also related to strong digital presence. So even though websites do not have physical locations, some companies have done great content marketing over the years. And when companies use business relevant search queries, they end up seeing the company content over time. I'm thinking of HubSpot, for example. So when you Google something related to marketing and especially marketing technologies, you're quite likely to see content from HubSpot. So this is their massive repository of content that they have been building. So they have this very strong digital presence in some of these teams that relate to their businesses. Relationships as a sustainable competitive advantage. So this can be strong brand relationships with customers. So I'm thinking of LEGO, for example, that has this very active community of LEGO enthusiasts that want to help out the company to develop products and serve as brand advocates and so on. Or then it can be strong interpersonal relationships with customers. So human to human. This is common in physical services. Think of hairdressers, for example. So once you have this loyal customer base, the customers, if they're happy with the service, they are quite prone to stick with the same hairdresser because the hairdresser already knows the style and who this person is. And maybe the small talk is not as painful if you have met this person many, many times. So you become it may become a friendship even. This is also very typical in all types of business-to-business services and business-to-business trade altogether, that the relationships between the salespeople and the buyers become very strong. So the bonds may become very strong, and therefore the companies are reluctant to change the service provider. Market position as a competitive advantage. Well, sometimes there might be a monopoly or other favorable regulations that limit competition. Think of alcohol sales in Nordic countries. There are limited set of players that can sell certain types of alcohol. So this might be one easy example of such competitive advantage. Economies of scale, which refers to reduced costs per sold item. This is often associated with market leaders. So those who are very strong players in the market, they can buy more items. So when they produce bigger volumes, they can buy more items and thus have a better negotiation power toward the suppliers. They also produce in bigger units, which means that the fixed costs of having these factories may be lower. They can also scale to some extent their logistics costs and so on. So that is what is often related to the economies of scale. Strong position in the value chain or ecosystem, which might be very close to the economies of scale, but generally it refers to the strong negotiation power towards suppliers and doesn't necessarily mean that you're a market leader. But one good example could be NVIDIA that produces these AI chips. And at the moment, it seems that they have a superior product. So it's part of the offerings advantage as well. So they have a superior product, and it seems that other competitors are not able to match that product. And this product is very essential for many, many technology companies that want to use AI. So it seems that they have this very strong position in the value chain, at least at the moment. Time will tell how sustainable that advantage will be. Then we have network effects that I will discuss in a little bit more. Resources and capabilities as competitive advantages. These are the drivers of genuine SCAs, or let's say maybe indirect SCAs. These can be related to innovativeness or technological capabilities. So some companies just have the processes that make them more innovative. It might be also related to the proprietary data or information. So they have a better understanding of customers. Think of technology companies like Amazon, Google, or Meta. They know quite a lot about their users and customers. So they can use that data to their advantage and create some competitive advantage based on that information. It can be related to human capital. So perhaps some companies just simply have superior people who are working for them that come up with new innovations. Or then it can be generally related to the organizational culture, which is something very difficult to observe, but you sort of feel it when you enter the company. So organizational culture is very important, but very fuzzy concept. But it is clear that companies with similar sort of resources come up with very different results. And it's mainly related to the organizational culture. It is said that organizational culture eats strategy for breakfast. So at the end of the day, it is about the feeling that the employees have in a company and their willingness to do their best day by day. And that's part of the organizational culture. As a final notion, after this long list of potential competitive advantages, it's important to understand that often the sustainable competitive advantage is a combination of different sources rather than just one single line here in the list. So many companies have multiple advantages that work synergistically. Let's talk about the evolution of competitive advantages and then focus on some of those advantages that are specifically important at the age of digitalization. So first of all, the evolution of SEA, I'm going to start with the right-hand figure here. So in the pre-industrial age, the competitive advantages were a lot associated with interpersonal relationships. So remember, this was the sort of agricultural era where a lot of the production was local, and it was important that the farmers and other entrepreneurs knew their customers. And this was somewhat feasible because many of the buyers were also locals. So these interpersonal relationships were very important to be successful in these local markets. Then, at the age of Industrial Revolution, so say 19th and 20th century, little by little the brands became important to signal product quality. And the reason for the emergence of brands was that the competition was no longer local, but it was national and gradually international. So it was impossible to know all the people or all the end customers in these wider geographical settings. So many companies kind of replaced the interpersonal relationships that provided the advantage to brands. So the end customers were not able to know the producers themselves, but they were able to recognize the brands. And this was the sort of golden age of branding that started to appear and intensified in the 20th century. Technology revolution, which I suppose could be said that it started in somewhere around, let's say, 80s, 90s. That's the time when, even though brands remained important, interpersonal relationship re remained important, but these offerings and innovations became the very key source of differentiation. So especially thinking about the most valuable companies in the world, they started to be technology companies. So Apple appeared and Google appeared and these types of companies. So they came up with something very innovative in their offerings and innovations, and that became the dominant competitive advantage. More recently, we have moved into a service economy where most of the business is actually service-based, and relationships, brands, offerings remain important, but there is this clear trend toward servitization. So a lot of companies, technology companies, industrial companies are moving towards being service companies. And this is an interesting phenomenon that we're gonna discuss in a bit. So digital age SCAs may be the most dominant, or at least the ones that are quite easy to observe, are servitization. And then related to it, scalability, complementarities, and platformization. So these are the distinct ones that we're going to discuss. But before that, on the left-hand side in this graph, which is a bit messy, you can see the number of firms listed in S&P 500 from different sectors over the years. So S&P 500, roughly 500 most valuable companies in the United States. And you can see the shifts that I just discussed quite easily in the graph. So it starts from 1969, where we were still very, or the markets were dominated by industrial companies. So about one third of the most valuable companies in US were industrial companies. But you can see the sharp decline over the years. And now in 2020s, the number of industrial companies as the most valuable, as a share of most valuable companies, have decreased heavily. Instead, information technology has become really important. More and more most valuable companies in the world are information technology, especially if you look at top 10 most valuable companies in US or in the world. Those represent heavily information technology. So you can see the technology revolution there. And many of these technology companies have become also service companies. So they are software related services and stuff like that. The other industry that has gained traction is healthcare. So again, service company. Many others have remained relatively stable. But now let's talk about some of these digital age SCAs, and I'm talking about servitization first and using Apple as a case to illustrate the point. So even though all of us know Apple very well from its hardware, so the iPhones and iPads and so on, and many people think that Apple is a product company, but surprisingly, the service business unit of Apple is actually one of the biggest service companies in the world. So as you can see in the middle, Apple Services business unit is bigger than Boeing, Nike, American Airlines, Intel, Coca-Cola, Netflix, or McDonald's. So it's a huge service business, and many people don't even realize that. So Apple's share of revenue from services has increased from about 10% to 25% in the last decade. So here you can see the shift, even for the technology companies, toward being service businesses. And why do technology companies and many other companies want to be service businesses? It is because of digitalization and the idea that the digital services usually come up with the very handsome gross margins. So the gross margin of services is around 70% for services compared to 35% for products. If you're not familiar with what gross margin is, maybe easy way to think about it is that for every euro that they make money, or let's say they have every euro that they generate revenue, 70 cent of that is profit. So the margin difference is huge, and this is one of the drivers why many companies want to rely on services, especially the digital services that are highly scalable, that I'm going to discuss next. On the right-hand side, you can see some examples of what are these Apple services, but it's a clear shift in the strategy of Apple to move toward services. Scalability. So first of all, what does that mean? It refers to an organization's ability to grow without being hampered by its structure or available resources when faced with an increased production, whether in a financial context or within the context of the business strategy. Simple way to put this, the firm can handle increased demand without significantly increasing costs. And especially digital services are highly scalable, which drives digital servitization. So this figure is trying to give, rough illustrations how the scalability of digital services work. So often you need a lot of investments to first create these services. But if they gain traction among the consumers, then the mathematics works quite nicely. The more users you get, more payable customers you get for your digital services, the more money you make. But the costs do not follow the revenue that tightly. So the costs do not increase at the same pace with the revenues. So once you have the digital service at place, it doesn't really cost a lot to run and operate that digital service. There is no production cost, there is no logistics cost, and so on. So the more users you get, the bigger your margin. So the area between these arrows is roughly the margin discussed in the previous slide. So this is why digital service is a very lucrative business. And it creates these so-called winner takes all markets, like what we can see in many sectors or categories in digital services, that there is the one or few very dominant digital services for a specific purpose that become bigger, and the others are not that successful. And why does this happen? Well, it's related to this scalability because all of this margin that the companies are making, they can invest back into the business. So the more users they get, the more money they have for marketing or product development to make the service even better, at useful features or so on and so on. So the more dominant the digital service becomes, the more money they're making, the more they can invest in their service, and hence the service becomes better and better while the others are struggling to be profitable. When comparing to the physical products, the key difference is that, well, you still need the upfront investments. You need to have the production units, machines, and so on. But when you start selling, this is where the key difference becomes. So every single product that you produce comes with a cost, self-evidently. So it costs something. You need raw materials, you need components, whatever you're producing. And then you need to deliver these products. So these are at least the two major costs that are involved in physical products. And these are absent, to an extent, from the digital services. You probably need computing power, and obviously you need a lot of people to work on the services. But however, and this is the major reason why the margins tend to be skinnier compared to digital services. Next, the complementarities. So here is a traditional example of how complementarity strategy work. It is also called razor and blade strategy in some part of the literature. It was innovated, or at least Gillette became very famous for this razor and blade strategy. So the idea of complementarities is that the core durable product is sold at cost or very little margin, while the disposable product associated with the durable product is sold at the wide premium. So if you look at the figure that clearly depicts the Gillette case, so they had this idea a long, long time ago that they are going to sell the razor with almost at cost, so at the same price that it costs to produce the product. And the psychological idea behind was that when a customer decides which razor or handle they are going to buy, people are quite price sensitive and they compare the prices in different brands. Once they have bought this razor or the handle, then they can start selling the blades with premium price. And again, from the psychological perspective, when the consumers already have the handle, then they might not be so price sensitive regarding the blades. So no matter what the blades cost, they're just going to buy them as it's kind of like a habit that you just buy them without thinking how much these blades cost. So this was the original idea, or at least this is how I've heard the story, that Gillette was the one that at least became very famous for this strategy, and this was the Gillette's original idea. The general idea is to create a lock-in with the core product or service. So once the customers buy the razor, it creates this lock-in to buy the blades. And then you can reap the profits via add-on product services or premium features. So now in the age of digitalization, we have a lot of examples that at least seem to follow the same logic. Although I don't have the numbers, you know, if they sell the core product at cost or with large premium, but at least this could be instances where you could use it. Amazon Kindle, for example, so it is this ebook reader, and it appears that the device is not very expensive. So they probably sell it with rather skinny margins. But once you buy the device, guess where you need to buy all the books? From the Amazon bookstore. So those are the add-on services. You don't do much with the device itself, but once you start buying those ebooks, then Amazon can make profits out of those purchases. Perhaps in the gaming consoles, we can see a similar pattern. So there is a lot of competition between, especially, I guess, Sony and Xbox. And I suppose the products need to match in terms of pricing. So they try to sell the console with as little margin as possible to be competitive. But once the customer has bought the gaming console, then they are very likely to buy the games that fit to this particular console. So it's another way to make profit out of it. Dropbox, which is a service for saving files, roughly speaking. And they operate with this freemium model. So you can start saving your documents and pictures and whatnot files in Dropbox free of charge. But once you exceed a certain limit, then you need to start paying for a premium subscription. And again, I think the lock-in works quite nicely because once you already have a limited amount of your files in this service and you're getting used to how to use it, you have integrated with your laptop or mobile phone or whatnot, then once you exceed the limit, you are quite likely to pay for the premium because you want to keep on using the service. And there is this lock-in effect, as mentioned. Finally, platformization. So definitely in the last decade or two, the different types of platforms have become very powerful sources of competitive advantages. So the platforms that get a lot of users, it's really difficult to compete against those sort of dominant platforms. And it's related to a network effect sometimes. So direct network effects means that the more users, the more value for existing users. Think of Facebook, for example. So if you were the only user on Facebook, the value would be limited, or it would be zero. There would be no value in using Facebook on your own. But the more users, the more friends are on that same platform, or what, it can be Facebook or whatever social media platform. So the more users, the more value for existing users, because then you can network and discuss and interact with other users, and also the company can, in this case, Facebook can tailor content for specific. So let's say the more users, the more content there is, and the more targeted Facebook can be in tailoring content for specific consumer interests. So this is sometimes called the direct network effect. And it's really hard to compete against these types of, although we've seen a lot of competition for Facebook, but Facebook still remains to be very big. Two-sided network effect means that the more the buyers, the more the sellers. To put it bluntly. So think of Wolt, for example, that works as a platform for buying restaurant food for the most part, as far as I know. So the more restaurants there are on this platform, the more attractive it is for the consumers. The more restaurant food buyers there are, the more attractive the platform is for the restaurants. And thus, both parties benefit from more buyers and suppliers. It makes a good value proposition for both restaurants and the end consumers. Meaning that once you have this dominant platform regarding restaurant food or whatever the sector might be, it's really hard to compete against. It's really hard to build the next platform and then try to attract the consumers and the restaurants, because in the early phase, it is not usually very attractive for the restaurants or the consumers, because there are too little or too few consumers in restaurants. So this is part of the reason why some of these platforms become dominant. It's really hard to attract the new users for the new platforms. The other discussion related to platformization relates to D2C, direct-to-consumer model. So theoretically, at least, digitalization allows you, the producer, to deliver products directly to consumer. So in other words, you can cut off the middleman. Perhaps you need a distribution partner. But this can be a good model to create this sort of brand platform, but it requires a very strong brand. And here are a few successful cases that have been able to create a brand platform where you can sell your, where you can attract sufficient amount of consumers to your platform and then sell your products. But most of these cases tend to fail. Even the big ones seem to fail to an extent. So, for example, Nike, which is a very, very famous brand, so it has the brand to attract consumers, but still, they are suffering at the moment. So Nike got excited about direct-to-consumer model a long time ago, and they have been gradually increasing the sales. And especially at the time of COVID, Nike realized that perhaps they should put more efforts to their D2C model, and they decreased their presence in retailers. But now it's starting to backfire, according to many reports. So even Nike is thinking whether this is a good model. Because we have these brand platforms, but then again, we have these retailing platforms. And it seems that these retailers that aggregate all kinds of different brands seem to be more dominant in the digital age. So the likes of Amazon and Zalando and these types of companies that do not sell just one brand, but many, many, many brands. So they give the options for the consumers, and it seems to be the model that consumers prefer. And therefore, the D2C model hasn't been very successful in most cases, although there are these certain success cases. Now, to conclude, in talking about different competitive advantages in the digital age, we've been talking about differentiation, and here I just want to underline the difference. So, why we talk about competitive advantages is that it enables a company to differentiate from competitors. So that is the key driver to genuinely differentiate from competitors, but this is only possible if the competitive advantage creates superior value for the customers. So customers must care about this competitive advantage. It must be something that actually can be seen in the end products or experiences. And secondly, the competitive advantage is translated into a value proposition that differentiates the firm's offering in the target customer's minds. So this is the other key prerequisite. So you need to be able to explain what the actual difference is so that the customers can perceive what is this source of differentiation and why should they bother to buy from this company. Thus, building a competitive advantage requires a deep understanding of target customers or the buyer personas so that you know what are the needs. And then you need an ability to communicate how the firm's advantage is converted to customer value in ways that competitors cannot match. So the differentiation. And this already relates to the discussion that we'll have in the forthcoming sessions on value creation and value proposition. So I'm hoping that after this lecture, you have better means to analyze how a firm can leverage competitive advantages to differentiate itself from competitors in the digital age. Pay attention to these things when looking at different companies. Thanks for joining and have a great day.